This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The new Jim Crow, mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness.
Michelle Alexander argues that mass incarceration amounts to a devastating system of racial control. She's related the story of Jarvis Cotton. Jarvis's great-great-grandfather couldn't vote as a slave. His great-grandfather was beaten to death by the Ku Klux Klan for attempting to vote. His grandfather was prevented from voting by Klan intimidation. His father was barred by poll taxes and literacy tests. Today, Jarvis Cotton cannot vote because he, like many black men in the United States, has been labeled a felon and is currently on parole.
Former litigator turned legal scholar Michelle Alexander argues that we have not ended racial caste in America. We have simply redesigned it. Alexander shows that by targeting black men and decimating communities of color, the U.S. criminal justice system functions as a contemporary system of racial control, even as it formally adheres to the principle of colorblindness.
Michelle, why don't we begin with the notion of racial caste? Certainly people are more familiar with that in third world, if you will, countries. But what do you mean by caste?
Well, when I use the term caste, and most people think of caste systems in the United States as being slavery and Jim Crow, when I speak of caste, I'm speaking of a system of rules, laws, policies, practices, and customs that operate collectively to lock a group of people defined largely by race into an inferior second-class status by law. And that is how our criminal justice system works today. The system of mass incarceration has operated to ensure that millions of people, primarily poor people of color, are locked into a second-class status in which they may not be able to vote, will be barred from juries for the rest of their lives, and will be legally discriminated against in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits simply because they've been branded a felon. Through the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, millions of people have been swept into the criminal justice system, primarily for nonviolent and drug-related offenses, swept into the system, branded felons, and then ushered into a permanent second-class status in which they are stripped of many of the rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. That's why I say we haven't ended racial caste in America. We've merely redesigned it.
And how did we get to this point after having had victories in the civil rights movement in the 60s? How did we get to this point where now we have to fight this demon?
Well, the emergence of mass incarceration can be traced to the backlash against the civil rights movement. You know, at the same time that enormous gains were being made by civil rights activists and organizers in the civil rights movement, there was a fierce backlash underway. And segregationists and former segregationists found that they could no longer use racially explicit rhetoric to preserve the social order. They could no longer say segregation forever, but they could get away with saying law and order and get tough on them. Racially charged code language for referring to a group of people not so subtly defined on the basis of race. And pollsters and political strategists found that this get tough rhetoric was extremely successful in appealing to poor and working-class white voters, particularly in the South, who were threatened by, anxious about, resentful of many of the gains of the civil rights movement, particularly busing, desegregation, and affirmative action. You know, poor whites really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. Wealthy whites could send their kids to private schools and give their kids all the advantages that wealth had to offer. But it was poor whites who were already struggling and who felt vulnerable themselves, who found themselves having to compete for the first time with this whole other group of people who they had been taught their whole lives to believe were inferior to them, for limited jobs, decent jobs in fire departments, police departments. And this fear and anxiety and growing resentment led to a real political opportunity among, for those who were willing to exploit those racial divisions. So political strategists, as part of the so-called Southern strategy of using this racially coded, racially charged rhetoric on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to these folks. In fact, in the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he says, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did. The war on drugs was an effort by President Ronald Reagan to make good on campaign promises to get tough on a group of people who had been defined not so subtly as black and brown in the media and the political discourse. It was President Richard Nixon who was the first to coin the term a war on drugs, but it was President Ronald Reagan who turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And he declared that drug war not in response to rising drug crime, because in fact at the time the drug war was declared, drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. At the time President Reagan declared his drug war in 1982, drug crime was on the decline, and it was a couple years before crack hit the streets and inner city communities and later spread to urban areas across America. The war on drugs was declared in response to racial politics, not drug crime. And it has led to the quintupling of our prison population in a few short decades and the emergence of a vast new racial undercast.
There's an exponential population growth of those incarcerated, but hasn't, in effect, the use of the penal system been a primary population control mechanisms for particular groups of people within our society, particularly at times where there's a changing economy, where there's a surplus workforce that's not really needed? Is there anything particularly different today in the use of the penal system to keep black men behind the walls than there has been really for decades previously?
Well, yes, many people say, well, the criminal justice system has always been biased against African Americans and black men in particular. How is, today's mass incarceration different than what's happened in earlier eras? And it's true that the system has always been biased, but never in the history of this country has incarceration been used on such an extraordinary scale. In fact, there are more African Americans under correctional control today in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. The scale of this system is astonishing, mind-boggling. But you're right that, its function is different in many ways than the function it performed in the past. The war on drugs and the Get Tough movement was launched at precisely the same time that inner city economies were suffering from collapse. Factories were closing down in major cities like Chicago, Detroit, Baltimore, all across the United States. The industrial system was collapsing, crumbling. And those hardest hit were those in inner city communities. Many factories had been located in inner city communities or very close to them so they could have cheap access to black, quick access to cheap black labor. Well, once those factories began closing down, hundreds of thousands of African Americans were suddenly jobless. William Julius Wilson has described this phenomenon in his book, When Work Disappears, how African-American men in particular became stranded within, you know, a 10 to 15 year period, went from holding down decent jobs that could support a family to being jobless with no hope of employment, trapped in racially segregated ghettos. So hundreds of thousands of people were suddenly jobless, and we could have responded to this crisis in inner city communities, you know, with a wave of compassion and, you know, economic stimulus programs and investment in those communities, job training to help, you know, young black men in particular make the rough transition from, you know, an industrial to a more service-based economy. But no, instead of those kinds of supportive interventions, the war on drugs was declared. No longer needed to pick cotton in the fields or labor in factories, black and brown men were rounded up in droves and warehoused in prisons, where now many of them are forced to work for little or no pay. In fact, you may have heard about the courageous strike
in Georgia,
striking because they have been forced to work for no pay and denied basic human rights.
Michelle, let me, because one of the conclusions that you reach, and I want you to flesh this out too, perhaps to debunk some mythologies that are out there, and that is that incarceration rates are somehow pegged to crime rates, and you make it quite clear that there is no correlation. So flesh it out for us more.
Yes, that's one of the biggest myths about mass incarceration, is that the explosion in our prison population is due to an explosion in crime, and that incarceration rates are driven by crime rates. On some level, it's not surprising that people make that assumption. It's common for people to think that if crime is going up, incarceration rates are going up, and that the racial composition of our prisons and jails necessarily reflects the racial composition of those who are committing crimes. But in fact, it's not true. Our prison population has quintupled for reasons that have stunningly little to do with crime rates. And over the past 30 years, crime rates have gone up and have gone down, and today are at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Regardless of whether crime rates have been going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole, incarceration rates, particularly black incarceration rates, have consistently soared. So what does account for the explosion in our prison system? Well, the war on drugs has been a driving factor. In fact, between about 1985 and the year 2000, more than half of the increase in the state system was due to drug convictions alone, and more than two-thirds of the increase in the federal system was due to drug convictions alone. You know, to get a sense of how enormous a contribution the drug war has made to mass incarceration, you know, consider this. There are more people in prison today just for drug offenses than were imprisoned in 1980 for all reasons. So the drug war has swept millions of folks into the system, branded them felons, and then released them into this permanent underclass. More than 30 million people have been arrested in the drug war since it began. And, you know, although it's astonishing to think of a prison system that now holds more than 2 million people, the reality is that most people who are under correctional control in the United States aren't in prison. You know, there's more than 2 million people behind bars, but well over 5 million who are on probation or parole, who have been branded criminals and often felons for relatively minor drug crimes. When people hear the term felony, they automatically think of, you know, the most serious crimes. But in the United States, you can get a felony, in some states just for marijuana possession. And the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld life sentences, life imprisonment, for first-time drug offenses, something that's absolutely unheard of anywhere else in the world. So we have unprecedented levels of punitiveness in the United States, as well as enormous populations who are swept in, branded criminals and felons, and who may not do prison time, but pay for their minor crimes for the rest of their life by being relegated to a permanent second-class status and discriminated against in employment, housing, public benefits. You can even be denied food stamps in many states if you've ever been convicted of a drug felony.
Now, you say in your book, The New Jim Crow, that three-quarters of the imprisoned population are African-American. But African-Americans don't or didn't consume three-quarters of the drugs in this country. So how is this steered toward the African-American community, leaving the white community pretty much free?
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. You know, studies have shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. In fact, you know, where significant differences in the data are found, they often indicate that white youth are more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. You know, but that's not what you would guess by entering our prisons and jails, which are overflowing with black and brown drug offenders. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sentenced to prison have been African American alone. So the racial disparities in the drug war are immense. Now, how did this come about? Well, for two reasons primarily. One is that the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. You know, there is plenty of drug use, illegal drug use and dealing that occurs in middle-class white communities, on college campuses and universities, in white rural communities. But the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. And law enforcement has been granted enormous discretion regarding whom to stop, search, and treat as a drug suspect in this war, virtually ensuring that racial stereotypes and biases, unconscious stereotypes as well as conscious ones, will play a role in decision-making about who should be stopped on the freeway, who should be singled out for a frisk on the sidewalk. And these racial biases and stereotypes have produced enormous disparities. Virtually every study that has been done of police stops and searches in New York City and everywhere else in the United States have revealed enormous racial disparities. Who gets stopped and searched determines who gets swept in to the system. You can have equal rates of drug offending in two different communities, but if only one community is being swept regularly and if only one community is subject to routine stops and searches and frisks, well, drugs are going to be found among the members of that community rather than the one that is largely left alone. So the enormous disparities that we see in our prison system, racial disparities that we see in our prison system in the drug war, reflects biased enforcement, not, you know, grossly disparate rates of offending.
So these are mechanisms. The drug war became a mechanism for a very insidious and invidious way of penalizing and controlling the African American community. Talk more about what you think the policies are that are in place that make it appear as though there's a kind of colored blindness within the context of the criminal justice system, but very clearly is got a legacy of virulent racist policies, ideological sway, sense of, if you will, white supremacy that continues to victimize and now to such exponential quantities people of color that we are effectively destroying entire communities.
Our drug laws appear on the surface to be race neutral. But, of course, the same was true of literacy tests and poll taxes. The laws that authorized literacy tests and mandated poll taxes said nothing about race in the statutes themselves, but those laws were enforced in such a racially discriminatory manner that they effectively barred African Americans from the polls. Well, today, our drug laws, you know, on the surface, you know, say nothing about race, but are enforced in such a grossly discriminatory manner that they manage to effectively recreate a caste-like system. And many of the incentives that are built into the drug war are invisible to the general public. For example, federal funding has flowed in the drug war to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost dramatically the volume, the sheer number of drug arrests. It's a pure numbers game. Agencies are rewarded in cash for the sheer number of drug arrests they make through the Edward Byrne Memorial Grant Program. So, you know, it's not surprising then that law enforcement agencies go out and sweep these communities for the, so, you know, the quote-unquote low-hanging fruit. The incentive to round up as many people as possible is one of the reasons why the overwhelming majority of those swept into the system for drug offenses are for relatively minor nonviolent offenses. And, you know, for example, in 2005, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for mere possession. Only 1 out of 5 were for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or significant selling activity.
And this terrifyingly painful and serious subject, indeed, what is to be done?
I really believe that movement building is the answer, that piecemeal policy reform has no hope of ending the system as we know it. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration that we had in the 1970s, a time when many civil rights activists thought that rates of incarceration were egregiously high, but if we were just to go back to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Prisons across America, including, you know, many that have been built in rural communities, already teetering on the edge of economic collapse, those prisons across America would have to close down. It is going to take an enormous movement. You know, those who think that the economic crisis is going to result in a significant downsizing of the system in the absence of a broad-based movement, I think, are just engaging in fanciful thinking. You know, if any significant downsizing of the system gets underway, it's going to face fierce resistance, not only from the private prison companies, you know, listed on the New York Stock Exchange, who would be forced to watch their profits vanish, but also from prison guard unions, who are amongst the largest and most powerful political organizations in many states, and many of the corporate interests, you know, that now profit from caging human beings, everything ranging from the taser gun manufacturers to the private health care providers that provide typically abysmal health care to people in prison. All of these, you know, corporate interests and political interests that are so invested in mass incarceration will mobilize. And when they do, to defend the system, they will pay politicians to say, we must continue to be tough on them. And all of the racially coded, you know, language will reemerge. So it's going to take a movement, a large-scale, multiracial, multi-ethnic movement to bring this system to an end. I'm encouraged by the movement building that has already begun. There are wonderful folks organizing in New York and nationwide already to bring mass incarceration to an end and to end this history and cycle of caste in America. And I hope those in New York who are interested in moving this movement building work forward will attend an event in March 19th at Riverside Church, where there will be a book event for the new Jim Crow and the launching of a coordinated movement to end caste in America. And those who are interested, I encourage them to contact Jazz Hayden at jhayden512@aol.com. Again, that's jhayden512@aol.com to get involved in that organizing effort. And for those who want to learn more about the book or to obtain it, you can go to newjimcrow.com, newjimcrow.com.
And Jazz Hayden's a good friend of this station's and works tirelessly to deal with the collateral consequences, the consequences of the incarceration and subsequent to incarceration of African-American men in this society. And I want to just end with a lovely, really promo, if you will, by Lonnie Guinier, which says, Michelle Alexander's brave and bold new book paints a haunting picture in which dreary felon garb, post-prison joblessness, and loss of voting rights now do the stigmatizing work once done by colored-only water fountains and legally segregated schools. And she does it with dazzling candor. Alexander argues that we all pay the cost of the new Jim Crow. I encourage you to read the book and to pay close attention to the work of the stunning scholar, litigator, activist, Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Thank you for joining us, Michelle Alexander. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.